Welcome to Art Speak Radio. This is Maria Vasquez Boyd. I didn't forget about you. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Noon to one here on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. You know, I'm very excited to be with you today. Well, every day for, you know, for reals. But today I'm premiering a special program called Where Were You? And that asks individuals to contemplate and respond to a specific historical event or write a passage through their writing, and then they share their stories on air. So, you know, think about, well, for instance, when I was in art school, I asked my friend, Melissa Watson, I said, "So, Melissa, where were you when man walked on the moon?" And she says, "What month was it?" And I said, "Well, it was July." And she says, "What year?" 1969, she says, "I wasn't born yet." So her story is going to be very short. But you know, think about the where you were in these historical, when historical events took place. So today we're premiering with this special program that I've asked writers and performers to respond to. So we're going to begin with performer, entertainer, writer Jade Esteban Estrada, community activist, writer Miguel Morales, editor, radio host for the 10th Voice, Elizabeth Anderson, artist and co-founder of GLAM, Christopher Leach. They're going to share their personal stories and perspective of the Stonewall riots that took place June 28, 1969, at the Stonewall Inn. And it coincides with today's date, which is actually June 28th, so it was 48 years ago. I don't always do math right. But the Stonewall riots, and you can find more on Wikipedia, the Stonewall riots, also referred to as the Stonewall Uprising or the Stonewall Rebellion, it was a series of spontaneous, violent demonstrations by members of the gay LGBT community against a police raid that took place in the early morning hours of June 28, 1969, at the Stonewall Inn, located in Greenwich Village in Manhattan, New York. Now, they are widely considered to constitute the single most important event leading to the gay liberation movement and the modern fight for LGBT rights in the United States. So I want to introduce my first contributor. That would be Elizabeth Anderson. Again, she's an editor. She's the radio host, one of the radio hosts for the 10th Voice, Saturdays 1 to 2 p.m. So welcome, my friend.
Well, thank you, Maria.
Terrific. You know, I love that you contributed your voice to this, because I think your story is very unique. And that's really what I'm looking for, is just people telling their stories and offering a different slice of life. So,
well, I definitely was born in 1969. In fact, I was 17 years old. And when people say, "When did you first learn about Stonewall?" I actually don't know. In the 1970s, late 70s, I was teaching English composition at Cameron College in Lawton, Oklahoma. And older colleagues, they were mostly older, would over drinks ask each other, "Where were you during Pearl Harbor? Did you watch Queen Elizabeth's coronation? Did you see Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz on the big screen when it first came out? Or did you see Elvis in the 50s at concert?" And, of course, I didn't have anything to add because I was either not born or very little, and I didn't have an answer, but I enjoyed listening to them. And that's how I have felt for much of my life about Stonewall. Mm-hmm. Because when I'm asked, "Where were you during the Stonewall riots?" I'm completely at a loss. On June 28th, 1969, 48 years ago, I'm pretty sure I know what I was doing. I had finished my junior year at Minichog Regional High School in Wilbraham, Massachusetts. It was a Saturday, and I was probably playing softball all afternoon with the guys on the church ball field. And the church was a Swedish Evangelical Covenant church, pretty traditional and conservative. And so in the evening, probably my high league group went over to Friendly's for burgers and fribbles after playing Capture the Flag or practicing for a Gospel Airs concert. But there's also an excellent chance, because it was a month before, that I was inviting my church friends over to my parents' house to watch Neil Armstrong walk on the moon, because that happened on Sunday, July 20th, 1969. And, of course, he said the famous words, "That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." So I know exactly where I was in July 1969 when we landed on the moon, and mankind, womankind too, leapt forward. But I'm now aware in 2017 that 48 years ago, the LGBT community took a leap forward during the Stonewall riots through outrage and activism. They'd been pushed too far. I had no idea back then that there was a Stonewall Inn, or even that gay people existed. In fact, because I attended an arch-conservative Presbyterian college, we had required chapel, we had no co-ed dorms, no co-ed dining. It's still one of the most conservative colleges in the United States. I had not a clue about gays or lesbians, at least until my junior or senior year. It was about 1973, and a couple of men from the CIA visited, and they wanted to know if Jane down the hall had any special friends in the dorm, if she hung out a lot with women. And I found the questions very puzzling. They asked me, and I'm like, no. And dorm friends explained that her father was high up in the CIA, and they were doing a background check on her before her summer internship in the agency. They were making sure she wasn't a lesbian. It had never occurred to me that anyone in the dorm might be a lesbian. I certainly found that possibility intriguing. It was new information. Flash forward 20 years, and it's 1993. I was married to a man, my husband, had two small children. I was the editor of the internationally syndicated comic strip For Better For Worse that was in about 1,700 newspapers. And the gay teenager Lawrence came out in a six-week series in April 1993. As the editor, working closely with Lynn Johnston and taking tons of phone calls and reading letters and having people talk to me and doing newspaper and radio interviews all over, I basically was driven out of the closet, into therapy, and into a crash course of gay and lesbian history. When I came out, and it was 1993-94, I did a lot of reading to catch up because I didn't know anything. I was in my 40s. I was way behind my peers. So I read Stone Butch Blues, NIAID books, Lillian Faderman's nonfiction, Randy Schultz's books, such as The End of Band Played On about the AIDS crisis, and The Mayor of Castro Street about Harvey Milk. But Stonewall was still an enigma to me. It was a distant, hazy event familiar only through some writings and film. Two events in recent years helped me understand it better. One of those was the Pink Triangle Word Factory, organized in January 2015 by our friend Philip Blue Owl Hooser. And he, Mark Manning, and Miguel Morales made several of us weep with their recollections of the era of Stonewall, AIDS, and activism. Their memories were real and raw. After the mass shooting last year at Pulse, and that's the gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida, where there was a Latin-themed night, after that tragedy, I attended Brown Voices, Brown Pulse at the Matty Rhodes Art Center. As Miguel Morales and others spoke and sang, I learned even more about why activism and speaking out is critical for our community's survival. Stonewall came up again because accounts don't always reflect that transgender women of color had reached their tipping point. It wasn't a white riot. Two people who made an impact that night were Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, transgender women of color. Friends and I have talked about our fears in recent months, really since the election, as this administration and influential lawmakers launch assaults on the judiciary and the press. From the Supreme Court to state bills to personal attacks, LGBT people are under attack. Gains of the last 25 years could be swiftly rolled back without our community speaking out and acting in concert, no divisions. Activism for equality and justice is crucial right now. In fact, now that I am an older woman, a white lesbian who's 65, I frequently don't shut my mouth. If I hear someone say, well, I don't know any gay people, I'm likely to say, hi, meet me. I'm a lesbian. I'm Elizabeth. What's your name? And I think it's important to do that for all of us. To close, this past April, I was in New York City, and I stayed near the West Village. One Sunday morning, I walked over to Greenwich Village, stood outside the Stonewall Inn, strolled up and down Christopher Street, and sat for half an hour in Christopher Park opposite the Stonewall Inn. I sat on a bench gazing at George Segal's sculpture in the Pocket Park. It comprises two standing men and two seated women commemorating the Stonewall riots of June 28, 1969. While I was sitting there, two women came in with a young girl, who was obviously their daughter. After a bit, an older man entered. He had a cane, and he sat quietly with us. If I'm asked about the Stonewall riots, I will know now what they were and what they meant. I will know that I made a pilgrimage to remember on Sunday, April 30th, 2017.
That is beautiful. Thank you so much, Elizabeth. You know, again, lending your voices and your stories helps each of us understand not only the individual, but, you know, the circumstance, because we experience life so differently, you know.
We do. And, Maria, I want to mention during the readings in January 2015, you and I were sitting together.
Yeah.
And we just kept looking at each other when these incredibly poignant personal stories from Miguel and Mark and Philip especially. We both teared up.
And it was just a beautiful celebration event to honor everyone and you know, the struggle. But I met so many people that afternoon, too, at Prospero. So that was really a beautiful evening.
Yeah. Well, thank you for asking me.
You bet. You know, we're going to be right back with ArtSpeak Radio after these brief messages. Hello and welcome back to ArtSpeak Radio. This is Maria Vasquez-Boyd. We have a special edition of ArtSpeak Radio, a monthly little segment that I'm going to add to the show called Where Were You? So this special program, we ask individuals to contemplate and respond to a specific historic event through their writing and then share their stories on air. So this week we have Jade Esteban Estrada, Miguel Morales. We just heard from Elizabeth Anderson, and up next we have Christopher Leach. And Christopher Leach is an artist and designer living here in Kansas City. His writings, drawings, and design works have been broadly published and exhibited. His work has been exhibited across the U.S., including the Nerman Museum, University of Wyoming Museum of Art, the Museum Without Walls, the Kansas City Jewish Museum, Lidi Volkas Art Space, and so many more. His works are in private and public collections, including the Sprint Corporation, Nerman Museum, Community Christian Church, and the Art Institute of Chicago. Now, he's curated and organized many exhibitions and publications, including Desire for the Lytton International Artists Exchange Program, What We Did for Love, AIDS Walk T-shirt Collection, and Natural History on the Head at Kansas City Museum with Dr. Sue Rowley, Crossing Borders, History, Culture, and Identity in Contemporary Australian Textile Art, and that toured the United States and Australia. He's been published frequently in Art in America, New Art Examiner, Ceramics, Art and Perception, Art Papers Atlanta, American Craft, and International Design. And you're always a favorite here at the station. We love when you come in. Thank you for joining us, Christopher Leach.
Well, that makes me sound very fancy. I am so honored to be here. When you sent your email asking me to participate, I just felt so lucky to be included by someone who I think is so smart and so discriminating and so intelligent and so inclusive.
I love you.
So thanks so much.
I love you. But, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted your voice places because you have such a strong connection to the community, LGBT, to GLAM. Let's talk about just a little bit about GLAM.
Well, I mentioned it in my little piece here.
Okay.
It's GLAMA.
GLAMA, I'm sorry.
Because all gay and lesbian archives and collections have to have cute names, like the Ozarks Lesbian and Gay Archive, OLGA, and the project at KU Under the Rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
GLAMA, the Gay and Lesbian Archive in America, is a project that was launched by David Jackson and my husband, Stuart Hines. And this is housed at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and now comprises more than 3,000 shelf feet of papers and photographs and scrapbooks and three-dimensional objects documenting LGBTQIA XYZ history here in Kansas City. It's being researched. It's being published. There's this wonderful young man at the university now trying to make a film about the Equal Rights Ordinance using GLAMOR resources in his research. So it's just proof in the pudding of what we know in the museum and archive world. When you have a collection of stuff, then the history is real and your story isn't lost.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's kept in shoeboxes under beds and you have a hard time documenting your actual existence. And there are people, as Elizabeth just alluded to, who question the reality, the existence, the integrity of LGBTQ lives. And one of the roles that GLAMA can play is myth-busting in that way.
Terrific. Are you ready?
I am ready. I do a lot of promotional marketing and other descriptive writing, so it's really nice to have the chance to write an impressionistic memoir titled Standing on a Stone Wall. Saturday, June 28, 1969. I'm at the lake with my two brothers, my sister, and our parents. I have a buzz haircut from my cop dad and have carefully matched my shirt and my shorts, like my mom says. I am nut brown and barefoot. We fish and run after mayflies. I love the yellow ones. And hunt for arrowheads. It is the summer of a typical lower middle class Midwestern American family. We've come back to Tulsa after a miserable stint in California. I had a girlfriend there who's now a pen pal. She is wealthy and very stylish, and we meet at the advanced experimental school where my tests have placed me. My knowing her pleases my parents and makes my older brother jealous, which pleases me. I'm between third and fourth grades at a little Catholic school we can walk to. This is the fourth school of what will be six in my elementary career. We attend church with all those families and play with our neighbors in the street. We're German and English. My aunt has married into a large Italian family, and I know a Polish kid, Chuck, on my baseball team. That's as different as anyone gets, I guess. It will be years before I understand why I think Chuck's lips are so interesting, and why I like to imagine what Scott, the summer camp counselor, looks like in his tight white underwear. But I do, and I do. It will be years before I'm sexually assaulted again, and before I meet my high school boyfriend. I don't know what gay is, and I don't know if I know anyone who is other than what we now say are binary, cisgendered, and white. That is my summer of 1969. June 1979. I'm in Bixby, the little farm town south of Tulsa where we'd landed and stabilized. In our little town, everyone knows everything about each other, and I don't want any of my friends to know anything about me. After 4 years in the Catholic high school up in town and a year in junior college, I'm distant and fidgety. I've been trying to date girls, and I'm only interested in boys. I try to reconnect with my high school friend who is out on bail, and that lands with a thud. My grandmother one day confides in me the details of her daughter's first marriage to, as she says, a gentleman who preferred gentlemen. I long wonder why she told me that story. My sister-in-law last year suggests I should ask why she told me that story and none of my four siblings. So I'm hanging out with my friend from next door who I've known for 8 years. At his house, one day, is his high school buddy back from a year at the State University in Norman. I visited there a couple of times and am afraid to commit. No one in our family has been to college except my brilliant sister, and I'm not sure I can cut it. My friend's friend was in the art school, which I hope to enter, so I ask him about it. He unleashes a bitter rant about his time at the school. It's all just a bunch of fags, he says, running around with their purses and protesting everything. My ears have pricked up, and I hope I haven't betrayed my eager attention. What kind of purses, I wonder? What do they look like? Well, how can you tell they're fags? I try offhandedly. And he says, through a suspicious sideways glance, oh, you can tell. They want you to know. June 1980. Roberto and David are helping me get dressed. The striped shirt, then the green pants. David has socks that match, and I'll wear my good sandals. Jane, my lady friend, is in Mexico for the summer. The man I meet at the college town laundromat, the man 10 years older than me, with the sparkling eyes and the square jaw and the magnetic smile, who helps me fold my clothes, who went to art school in Kansas City, invites me to a party. I don't need to imagine what he looks like in or out of his underwear. We go out a couple of times, and his roommate Frank is having one of his parties, says Jim, rolling his eyes. And I'm invited. My first gay party. During the beautiful 2 years that follow, I realize I have gravitated into a circle. Okay, more like been cruised and swept into a harem of inventive, intelligent, creative, politically aware artists, designers, teachers, geologists, and engineers. We are living out proud lives. We date. We kiss in public. We speak openly about each other. I am only half aware of the impact of their emotional generosity. It's not as if, in central Oklahoma, in 1980, that bigotry and small-mindedness and hateful language suddenly disappear. It's that their shadows are shown to be the empty darkness they are by the brilliance of this gorgeous family who've welcomed me. It's so warm and natural. And Frank's clothes fit me. My straight sartorial allies eventually coldly disown me. I've become so gay, they say. I write a letter to my friend in Bixby, and he answers with a strained call from a payphone. He's read a story about a man who dies before telling his gay son he loved him. He didn't want that to happen to us, and he can never speak to me again. June 1984. My older band friend Ken persistently explains to me his versions of gay history. That's something older men like to do, and that I like about older men. His uncle was murdered that year by a hustler, and he's depressed and nostalgic. Ken's revelations of bar raids and arrests and oppression and cruelty are the grain of a pearl that grows and grows, with pride celebrations and a new lesbian bookstore and films and our unashamedly visible community. It'll be a few years before Patrick dies, and then Frank, and Rusty, and Greg, and Jameis, and David, and Kent. Before I ominously announce to my parents, I'm gay. And they say casually, well, we kind of figured that out. We love you. If there's someone you want us to meet, we're ready if you are. Before I leave Ken, and before the Arab leaves me, and I meet the most wonderful hillbilly. It's even more years until we form the archive and are conducting an oral history and learn of Kansas City's own Stonewall Rebellion, a group of queens and sissies and boys who, upon being raided at a bar, refuse to be transported in the wagon and insist on proudly marching single file, half out of drag and with smeared makeup and in their party clothes, the several blocks to the police station in the middle of the night. June 2017. My beautiful, inclusive friend asked me to think of my story about Stonewall, called Riots, and I prefer Revolution. It's then I start to put together the pieces. My little, romantic, Midwestern, Oklahoma sexual life is the legacy of these men, of the Kens and Victors who live through it, of the art students in Oklahoma who are inspired by it, of the Franks and Jims and Rusties who are emboldened by their example, of the Okie redneck and the Ozark hillbilly whose families are unavoidably colored by society, who blindly believe we don't need anyone's permission just to be, and so are. And all of us are standing on the shoulders of those original giants, those trans women and skinny boys and drag queens and dykes who were only children after all, who defiantly resisted and bested violence with its own strength and cried out in a voice that is still ringing one sultry, smoky June night in 1969.
That was incredibly beautiful and so moving.
Thank you.
You know, I thank you so very much for your contribution to this program, to the station, because we know you're a very good friend of KKFI.
Try to be.
And you do so many wonderful things in the community. So thank you, Christopher.
It's easy to be a good friend of an important resource like this, and I'm honored to be related to it. Thank you for inviting me.
We love you, and you'll come back soon, right?
You betcha.
Okay. Well, we're going to be right back with ArtSpeak Radio right after this. This is Maria Vasquez-Boyd, and you're listening to ArtSpeak Radio, Where Were You?, a special presentation about the Stonewall Riots that took place June 28, 1969. Today happens to be June 28, 2017. So we're going to hear next from Jade Esteban Estrada, who is America's Prince of Pride. He has performed in 7 languages and in 33 countries to date, and his hypnotic music can be heard on Golden Globe and Emmy award-winning police drama The Shield on FX. The Advocate calls him exquisite. Genre Magazine calls him the most exciting Latin pop artist ever to emerge onto the musical scene. Now, critics around the world have compared him to a cross between Andy Warhol and Billy Graham. And he is just a terrific performer, singer, songwriter, dancer. He studied dance along Jennifer Lopez and was a lead dancer from Madonna's Blonde Ambition. So much about Jade that you should know. He's contributed his story, and you're going to hear that right now.
The Story of Stonewall, A Family History, by Jade Esteban Estrada. Although the Stonewall Riots of 1969 took place a year before I was born, the event which sparked the beginning of the modern gay rights movement would eventually leave an indelible mark on the timeline of my personal and professional history. I was born in San Antonio, Texas, to an Army officer and his wife, and was always surrounded by an abundance of soft tacos, Tejano music, and stereotypical machismo. The city of my youth, which many would consider to be conservative to this day, nurtured at the time an anti-gay environment where the use of derogatory terms for gay people were par for the course, and not only went without reprimand, but was often encouraged. My unchanged soprano singing voice that I demonstrated in the school choir, which would one day grant me a successful music career, made my middle school years a daily test of patience and resilience. At the age of 18, I moved to New York in pursuit of a show business career. My first day in New York was, in every sense of the word, a rebirth. Picture Venus rising for Botticelli himself. It was a new me. Professionally, I was at once strong and confident about who I was and what I could contribute to the world. That was a new thing. Personally, New York would be the place where my life as a gay man began to evolve. I began to feel that I deserved more than the emotionally one-sided down-low encounters that are prevalent in the Latino community. For me, it was a total transformation. The Big Apple was also a place with a queer history, one I longed to explore. Additionally, it was a place where older gay and lesbian friends could be and were revered mentors. The world of theater was where I made these connections. Gay theaters in Greenwich Village included my old stomping grounds, the Wings Theater on Christopher Street. After rehearsals, my newfound community of gay artists would meet for the typical late-night fare. The hamburgers were great, the fries, not so much. Older thespians would share their stories of what gay life was like during the McCarthy era. There was almost a glow around them. When it was my turn to speak, they'd nod their heads. They could empathize. when I'd share my hometown experiences of having broken bottles flung in my direction by passing bullies. They seemed to understand what it was like to be rejected by family members back home. They'd been down that road years before. And like an apprentice of sorts, I was also told first-hand accounts of what happened on June 28, 1969, at 53 Christopher Street. Oh, I was also taught the practical methods of gay survival beyond Karate Kid-type drills of Broadway musical versus movie musical distinctions. I learned how to butch it up for particular auditions so that I might have a better shot at getting cast. One must learn how to turn it on and off in a believable manner, I was told. I wrote everything down. They knew how to use Konstantin Stanislavski's acting technique to conceal their true identities in the presence of danger. It was very X-Men. In the world of gay theater, they were my family, and I loved them. In 1994, I was living my life as an openly gay performer. I auditioned for a play that was seeking gay actors, a bit of a tough sell at the time. The production was going to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots. I read for the role of Sylvia Rivera, an aging Puerto Rican drag queen who started the riots by boldly flinging her shoe at police officers during a bar raid. I still remember the audition. Every word was familiar, and her voice immediately found a place in my heart. I won the role, but decided to pass on the opportunity in favor of a contract in Europe, but I never stopped wondering what it would have been like to play the street transvestite action revolutionary herself, Sylvia Rivera. By the end of the 1990s, I began to be more public in the press as an out gay Latin pop singer, much to the dismay of my record company. But I was always on the road, and that was good. As one fan in Tulsa, Oklahoma once put it after collecting my autograph, "Oh, I get it. You're the affordable Ricky Martin." That really happened, by the way. Well, this charming title won me the alliance with contemporary gay activists at GLAAD, the Human Rights Campaign, and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, which I embraced. I was also included on a compilation CD called Being Out Rocks, alongside the B-52s, Sarah McLachlan, and others. Fortunately for me, Ricky Martin was perhaps a little too expensive. During this period in my life, I recall performing at Simi Valley Pride in California. Part of my shtick, which I learned from my second appearance on the Jerry Springer Show, the 1990s answer to RuPaul's Drag Race, was to go out into the audience and sit on a person's lap during a song. It's a cabaret /burlesque thing. There was always an older person who would seem the perfect candidate. On this day, the shyness of a particular man struck me. It was the face of the aging victims of American homophobia. They too were my elders. Regardless of increasing gay rights, they were the pre-Stonewall generation who spent their youth in a mental holding cell in a silent but still present echo of oppression. Being around gay activists again reignited my own passion for LGBT rights. I wanted to share my knowledge of gay history that I'd learned from my village elders, but I didn't know how to go about it. While I was on tour in early 2002, I stumbled upon the book Stonewall by Martin Duberman. Reading his interview with Sylvia Rivera, I was immediately reminded of the role I declined, and for days I couldn't get her out of my head. How could I incorporate her story into my show? A song? A play? A book? I had no idea. A week later, I was on my way back to Brooklyn after a long day in Manhattan, and I opened up the New York Blade, the gay newspaper for serious news, and I read that Sylvia Rivera had passed away and that a rosary would be taking place from 6 to 9 p.m. It was 8:30 p.m. I jumped off the train, headed back to the village. Only a handful of people were in the darkened room, and there, laid out in a plain, open coffin, was the leading lady of the Stonewall riots, finally at peace. Her nose was bigger than I had imagined. Her hands were ice cold. The light, the fight, the rage was gone. My answer had finally come. In September 2002, in her honor, I created a solo musical comedy entitled Icons, The Lesbian and Gay History of the World, Volume 1. In it, I play Sappho, Michelangelo, Oscar Wilde, Gertrude Stein, Ellen DeGeneres, and the incomparable Sylvia Rivera. Thanks to Sylvia, Martin Duberman, and my village elders, I've made a career of sharing the story of the Stonewall riots with anyone who will listen. And 367 performances later, Sylvia Rivera continues to be the role of a lifetime. When I think of Stonewall, I think of my village elders, and I am so grateful.
We're going to go ahead and go with our next story from Miguel Morales, who is a writer, award-winning journalist. Here we go.
Okay, so here's the story. The Kansas City Public Library made me gay. Well, it made me a smart gay. When I moved to Kansas City in the late 1980s, I was newly queer and had never even been to a gay bar before. You know, back when those still existed. And I'd never seen a library as big as the one downtown. It was the main library back then, with thousands of books. Using the card catalog, I narrowed down the areas where most of the gay books were located. Now, my family knew I was gay, but bringing home a book about it probably would have sent my mom saying triple rosaries and lighting perfumed candles to Our Lady of Guadalupe. So, instead, I spent hours in the library just reading. I read biographies of gay men. I read about gays and lesbians in the Holocaust. I read about Stonewall. And while my knowledge of queer history began to expand, it was just that, history. Reprinted photos, reprinted writings, and reworked interpretations reflecting nothing about the present. Nothing about the growing catastrophe of the AIDS crisis. Nothing about being a queer brown boy. I read books by old queer white men about when they were young queer white men. Even accounts of Stonewall itself reflected stories about being white, gay men. But everything changed when I auditioned for and was cast in a local production of Doric Wilson's Street Theater, a play about the Stonewall riots. I was fortunate that Philip Hoosier who led our cast, and he is one of the most sensitive and caring, outrageous individuals, and so witty. I finally was able to see how people of color and women were not only involved in Stonewall, but that they started it. "I need you to be angry. I need you to be angry for a purpose," our director said to me in rehearsal. "You want to fight. You want to push back. You're ACT UP. Go to one of those meetings and see how they do it." Well, I had read about ACT UP in our local ACT UP chapter in the Bar Rags. And they were always chanting and yelling, and it seemed like everyone in the gay community just hated them. But Carl, our director, he wanted me to go, so I looked up the meeting date and place, and it was just a simple walk down the street from where I was living in Midtown at the time. It's where the Kemper Museum is now, but back then there was a house that was converted into a public space where community organizations could meet and have gatherings and all kinds of stuff. So, To my surprise, when I went to the meeting, Carl was there, and he gave me a big welcoming hug. Well, they started the meeting, and everyone went around, and they started introducing themselves by name, or rather, by a name. I listened and watched everyone as the meeting progressed, and I unlearned all that I had read and heard about ACT UP. I felt ashamed that I had such apprehensions and an overall negative perception of the group and its members. ACT UP KC was made up of infected and affected individuals. Not all of them were HIV positive. They never asked me, and I never asked them, because coming out as HIV positive was and still is a personal decision. AIDS taught me about the resiliency of gay men in the gay community and about what it takes to be an ally. ACT UP KC made sense to me. They were fighting for their lives, for our lives. Our rehearsals for street theater continued, and I kept attending the ACT UP meetings. I felt a deeper connection to my character and found similar connections in myself. I knew something was happening to me. Something was changing. All of those books that I read that explained about Stonewall were now shaping my understanding of how and why the riots happened and my place in it. I began to see how art and activism could come together. When facts, story, and creativity merge and are infused with passion, it becomes a force working through the artist, to the audience, to the community, and beyond. It's something I strive to do to this day. I'm not always successful at it, but I try. I try to take those stories that are not on the shelves of libraries, and even some that are. I try to use activism to bring them to the community. Stories aren't just there for entertainment. They educate. They move people. They create empathy. They offer connection and even resistance. Stonewall and ACT UP also taught me not to fear, not to avoid, not to deny anger and rage. They are tools, sharp tools, blunt tools, heavy, powerful tools. The people I read about in books, the men I stood with in the streets, they taught me how to channel my anger and my rage for good. And looking back, I had so much anger inside. If I hadn't found Carl Hippensteel, Mark Chaney, Silvio Rivera, Harvey Milk, Marlon Riggs, Madrid San Angelo, Ronnie Brenes, if I hadn't found those people, if they hadn't found me, if they hadn't rescued me, surely my anger would have consumed me. 2 years and 4 months before the Stonewall riots, 39 LGBT civil rights leaders from across the country came together for 2 days to plan strategies and to collaborate on gay liberation. And according to GLAMA, the Gay and Lesbian Archives of Mid-America, they met for the very first time at the State Hotel, which was located at 12th and Wyandotte, right here in Kansas City. That two-day conference included gay and lesbian leaders from the East and West Coasts. They included the two founding members of the Daughters of Belitis, the first lesbian advocacy group, founding members of One Inc. out of Los Angeles, and members of the Mattachine Society, one of whose founding members, Hal Call, came from Missouri. This group formed the North American Conference of Homophile Organizations, or NACHO, which I always thought was kind of funny, Nacho. I mean, I like to think that the members of Nacho ate nachos while they were here in Kansas City. You know, that I know that's silly. Anyway, after this big homo meeting or conference or queer conference or whatever you want to call it, a man named Drew Schaefer and some other people in Kansas City founded the Phoenix Society for Individual Freedom. It was Kansas City's first gay advocacy organization. So, when you ask, what is Stonewall? It's not about a random hot summer night when queers threw bottles and pennies at the cops. It's everything that led up to that moment. It's that moment and each moment that followed to this day. It's standing up for yourself by pushing back. It's standing up for your community by chanting in the streets. It's standing up for those who cannot by being a collaborator and not just an ally. It's standing up for those who survive bashings and beatings and fists and boots and baseball bats and batons. It's standing up for those who have died from cruelty of the Holocaust, from AIDS, from being burned alive in the upstairs lounge, from being shot on a dance floor on Latin night. They live with us and through us in every moment of every day. You know, a lot of queer and trans people died on the streets where we have our pride parades. They died fighting for my right to call myself a gay man, and so I do, proudly. But I also know it's not about labels, because we have grown as a community. We are gay and lesbian and bi and trans and non-binary and intersex and so many other identities that I'm still learning, that I'm still reading about. Stonewall is about being able to choose or refuse a label, but still honoring those who came before us. Yeah, Stonewall is about the moment. It's about everything that led up to the moment. It's that moment and each moment that followed to this day. What you do with those moments, how you celebrate those lives, the legacy you create, it's all up to you. That's what activism and resistance and being alive is about. That's what Stonewall is about. That's what ACT UP is about. That's what Pulse is about. It's those moments. My friends, my beautiful, fierce, fabulous people, this is your moment. What are you going to do with it? Thank you.
And that was Miguel Morales with his story. Very powerful reading today by all of our contributors. I want to say thank you to Jade Estevan Estrada, Miguel Morales, Elizabeth Anderson, Christopher Leach. Thank you so much for the beauty of your words and your passion. Thank you. And again, this premiered Where Were You? And we'll be having other stories from people in the community to contribute. Next week, July 5th, Frank Lingo will be on the program, along with Audrey Luna, Rich Burrell of Make 48. Please stay tuned for Jeff Harshbarger next, a Jazz Afternoon. I want to say thank you so very much for tuning in, listening to us today. I will get those recordings up so you can hear them in their entirety, and of course the podcast. I'll see if I can just get those slipped in there so that you can hear the entire stories without any of the glitches today. Thank you so very much for tuning in and making us a priority. Honey, I'm coming home.